Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Professor Alexander Nemirov for Outlandish Life, Peter Paul Rubens and the Baroque, exploring the dramatic art of the 17th century. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
Leader of MATLAB and Simulink Software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Scott Tong. This is Here and Now. Coming up, the CDC Advisory Committee is considering drastic changes to the vaccines it recommends for babies.
Also, an admiral briefs lawmakers about his role in a highly scrutinized strike on a suspected Venezuelan drug boat.
And the Trump administration raised the idea of creating a 50-year mortgage. Could mean lower monthly payments, but the interest could really pile up.
Most people move, or they refinance, or they pay it off early. So most people aren't paying the interest over the 30 years, and they probably wouldn't over the 50 years either.
Plus, our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, dishes out some recipes from her favorite cookbooks of the year. Coming up, Here and Now.
The news is first.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. After a nearly five-year investigation into who put pipe bombs near the U.S. Capitol complex ahead of the January 6th insurrection, the FBI believes it has its man. Here's Attorney General Pam Bondi.
Early this morning, Brian Cole Jr. was arrested and charged with placing the pipe bombs at the RNC and the DNC on January 5th, 2021.
The suspect's being charged with transporting an explosive device in interstate commerce and attempted malicious destruction by means of explosive materials. The Pentagon's Inspector General says Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth risked the safety of U.S. troops by sharing key information on a planned U.S. bombing mission in Yemen. NPR's Greg Myrie reports Hegseth says he's been cleared of any wrongdoing.
The lengthy report by the Inspector General says Secretary Hegseth, quote, created a risk to operational security that could have resulted in potential harm to U.S. pilots. Back in March, Hegseth used the publicly available Signal messaging app to share detailed information on a U.S. airstrike against Houthi forces in Yemen. The information Hegseth received from the general overseeing the operation was marked secret. Hegseth then shared the contents, which included, quote, strike times of manned U.S. aircraft over hostile territory approximately 2 to 4 hours before the execution of those strikes. Hegseth responded to the report on X, saying, total exoneration, case closed. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Washington.
Vaccine advisors to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention unexpectedly postponed controversial votes on changing the current recommendation of universal immunization of newborns against hepatitis B. The hepatitis B virus attacks the liver. The disease has no cure, and chronic infection can lead to serious outcomes such as liver cancer, cirrhosis, and death. The risks are much higher for people who get infected as infants. The Trump administration has recently fired more than a dozen additional immigration judges, bringing the total number of terminated judges to 90. NPR's Jimena Bustillo reports.
Immigration judges are more like other federal workers than like judges in the judiciary. The courts are housed in the Justice Department, in the executive branch of government, not the judicial branch. And that makes it easier for the attorney general to fire them. Most of the judges this administration fired had still been in their two-year probationary period, but many of those in recent terminations had been with the agency for years. That expands the scope of who could be targeted by future rounds of firings. Immigration advocates warn the layoffs contribute to an already years-long backlog for immigrants to have their cases heard. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. State Attorney General Rob Bonta says a recent wave of shootings in Northern California shows that California's strict gun laws don't make the state immune to the national gun violence crisis. Speaking Wednesday, Bonta said a lack of federal intervention allows guns to easily cross borders into California from states with less strict laws.
California is a blueprint for what all states should do, what the federal government should do if we are serious about tackling gun violence. If every state did what California is doing, if the United States did what California is doing, we would save tens of thousands of more lives from gun violence.
His remarks came just a day after a student was shot at a San Francisco high school and follows a mass shooting in Stockton last weekend that left four dead, as well as recent campus shootings in Oakland. The San Jose Junior Sharks have agreed to a $4.6 million settlement over allegations they failed to intervene as a hockey coach groomed and sexually abused young players. Attorney Mark Boscovich represents a child who was allegedly abused by former coach Kevin Whitmer over 2 years. Boscovich says staff and parents raise concerns about Whitmer, including when he improperly gave private lessons in locker rooms.
The locker room policies at this facility were not being enforced, allowing Whitmer to isolate my client and several other minors in these locker rooms.
Whitmer pleaded no contest to charges relating to abuse of children and has a sentencing hearing set for tomorrow. In a statement, Shark Sports and Entertainment emphasized that there was no finding of wrongdoing on the company's part. I'm Brian Watt. Thanks for listening to KQED News.
Afternoon. Support comes from Postman, offering a platform to assist teams build APIs to help API agents make decisions. Postman.com. Support for NPR comes from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And by the sustaining members of KQED.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now. An influential committee that advises the CDC on vaccines has postponed a vote today on changing recommendations for vaccinating newborns against hepatitis B. The Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices had its previous members removed this year by the Health Secretary, Robert F. Kennedy, Jr. He is a known vaccine skeptic. The new members were considering a change in advice on hepatitis B shots, and they were due to discuss the overall vaccine schedule. But the meeting fell into confusion and disagreement, and the committee is now pushing the vote to tomorrow. I spoke to Dr. William Schaffner before this news broke in just the past hour. He is a former voting member of that CDC committee and a professor of preventive medicine at Vanderbilt University, and asked him to remind us exactly what hepatitis B is.
Hepatitis B is a viral infection of the liver, which can cause a chronic smoldering infection that down the road can lead to cirrhosis and liver cancer. One of the ways it's transmitted is if a mother who has this chronic infection, usually unknown by the mother, can transmit that infection to her newborn baby during the birth process. In which case, the baby has a very, very high likelihood, 80 to 90%, of becoming infected and developing these long-term infections.
I understand. Well, let's talk about the vaccine. The current recommendations in this country, going back to the early 90s, call for new babies to get this vaccine in the first 24 hours. This panel advising the CDC is considering a change to recommend that only children born to women who are hepatitis B positive get the shot at birth. Your thoughts?
My thought is we tried that before 1991, and it simply did not work for a whole variety of reasons. At the present time, about 15 to 20% of women simply don't have the test. There are times when the test is falsely negative. That is, the woman's truly positive, but the test reads it as negative, etc. So the committee decided way back in 1991 just to give the vaccine to every baby in the United States, and that has been brilliantly successful in virtually eliminating transmission to newborn babies, and that protection now extends into the 20s, and it's nosing into the 30s now, and hepatitis B rates are plummeting in that age group, 20 to 29, which is, of course, where lots of people have sexual intercourse and also some use drugs, which are other means of transmission of this virus.
Yeah. Doctor, I understand several wealthy countries do not advise the birth dose as we have in the U.S. Is that right?
That is correct. And, of course, they're smaller. Their countries are more uniform. We have a much more diverse country, and in those countries, they have cradle-to-grave medical care. We don't have that here. We have issues with access to medical care. And so it's clear that the strategy of trying to test all those mothers looks great on paper, simply did not and will not work. The goal is to actually interrupt transmission, not only to every child, but we want to interrupt the transmission in our whole society. And in order to do that, we all have to participate.
Yeah. I want to ask about the history of this vaccine schedule and play some sound from Hepatitis B Foundation President Sherry Cohen talking on CBS. Let's listen.
The vaccine is safe. The vaccine is effective. Over a billion, with a B, doses of the vaccine have been given out in the past 40 years.
Over a billion. When you take this long view, what do you worry about if this recommended change actually happens at the CDC Advisory Committee?
Scott, we'll turn the clock back to the bad old days, and once again, we'll have more transmission to infants, more chronic disease. The care for those patients down the road costs a lot of money. It won't be a good thing.
Yeah. As you know, the Health Secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., has claimed a link between Hep B vaccines and autism. No scientific evidence for this. For parents out there, what can they expect to hear from this administration, from the CDC, and where, in your view, might those claims not be supported by the data?
Well, I think there will be a lot of confusion among parents. And the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Academy of Family Physicians, the Infectious Disease Society of America all continue to endorse the birth dose. At bottom line, talk to your provider, that pediatrician who's going to take care of that baby during the baby's childhood.
Yeah, and very briefly, you've been on this committee. How important is this panel?
This is a very important vote and a very important issue, and I hope that we continue to use the birth dose ongoing.
All right, Dr. William Schaffner is professor of preventive medicine at Vanderbilt University, former voting member of this panel. Dr. Schaffner, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
A top Navy commander spoke with lawmakers today in a highly anticipated briefing on Capitol Hill. Admiral Frank Bradley shared details of a September 2nd strike on a suspected Venezuelan drug boat. The Pentagon is under tremendous pressure to explain why Admiral Bradley allegedly ordered a follow-up strike on two people who survived the first attack. We have Rachel Van Landingham with us now. She's a former military lawyer and current law professor at Southwestern Law School in Los Angeles. Rachel, it's nice to speak with you.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
This briefing was classified, so we don't know exactly what Admiral Bradley said, but we did hear this from Representative Jim Himes, the senior Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, who was in the briefing room.
The admiral confirmed that there had not been a kill-them-all order, and that there was not an order to grant no quarter.
So the reporting had been that Secretary Hegseth initially gave an order to kill everyone on board. Your reaction to this update?
Well, of course, such an initial order would have been clearly unlawful and actually a war crime if there was actually a war actually ongoing. So it's actually, it's good news that there was not a no quarters order given. But I do think there are many questions left regarding, what were the rules of engagement? Why were these two apparently distressed shipwrecked survivors of the initial strike subsequently targeted?
News organizations are reporting that Admiral Bradley ordered the second strike because the survivors were climbing back onto the boat and allegedly making distress calls to the cartels. What do you make of that legal justification, that essentially the second strike happened because the people on the boat weren't out of the fight?
Well, there was no fight to begin with. I mean, this is alleged drug smuggling. This is not armed combat. This was not a battlefield. This was alleged drug runners who were then summarily executed. Drug running in the United States, drug distribution is a federal crime as well as state crime. I mean, we have for over 40 years been interdicting and individuals running drugs on the high seas and prosecuting them in federal court. And so, again, there was no fight that they could return to. And so I do find that the first strike was unlawful. And these were not shipwrecked sailors on a warship that were trying to call in airstrikes. These were individuals who were clinging to what we could all see from the first video that was released, clinging to a burning, you know, a vessel that was on fire. They were desperately trying to save their lives. So it makes a second strike even more morally troubling. And it's incredibly problematic that our military is being put in the crosshairs and being told to execute such concerning missions.
Well, I take your point that you're saying it was the first strike that was also unlawful. But one of the key questions now that folks are debating is whether the wreckage of the first attack would be considered a shipwreck. Can you clarify what exactly the military's rules of engagement say about that and why that may be of importance here?
Well, I would have to actually see what the shipwreck, what the data showed, what they knew in their during their chats and their assessment. So there was no, first of all, there was no rush here. There was no imminent threat. These folks were not engaged in any kind of classic hostilities. They were allegedly running drugs. So there was no imminent threat. So there was plenty of time to engage surveillance and to ensure exactly what were they doing at the time. And so the idea that simply by calling other individuals, so a shipwreck, was their ship able under locomotion? Was it still able to go? Wasn't there time to actually go in and send in individuals to save them? Which actually would be pragmatically the right thing to do if you're actually interested in stopping illegal drug flow, because then you could detain them and you could ask them questions and obtain intelligence and then prosecute them and help bring down a greater ring. So this whole thing is just really built on this fairyland Alice in Wonderland theory that this is actually armed conflict, this is actually war, and instead we're asking our military and telling our military to engage in what seems like murder on the high seas.
Well, there has been a lot of talk about whether a service member can and should refuse an unlawful order. Now, the administration, as we've been saying, says both strikes were legal. You dispute that. But in the heat of the moment, how would someone like Admiral Bradley make a decision not to comply? How would that work?
It would work by what we seemingly are seeing with Admiral Halsey, who resigned because he was so troubled by this campaign of illegality. And so it is an incredible tough moral quandary and legal quandary, because a service member and Admiral Bradley, you know, after decades of honorable service, knows that he disobeys at his peril. Right. And so he could be prosecuted for disobedience, but it's actually his moral and legal duty to disobey a clearly unlawful order. And the hard part here is that there was a Department of Justice legal memo, allegedly, because it's still classified, providing a legal justification for this strike and apparently for subsequent strikes of anyone that's at all linked to this, you know, dubious, ambiguous drug cartel that the administration has not been transparent about. And so I do think our military is being put in a very difficult situation.
Rachel Van Landingham is a former military lawyer, current law professor at Southwestern Law School in Los Angeles. Rachel, thanks for your insights. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Stay with us. It's Here and Now.
All things considered, coming up at 1 o'clock, here's what's ahead.
We hear the word ideology a lot these days. Both conservatives and liberals use the term, but people tend only to refer to something as an ideology if they disagree with it.
Ideology has essentially become a form of name-calling. It's a way of sort of saying you have ridiculous or stupid beliefs.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. How the meaning of ideology has changed on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for KQED comes from the Museum of Craft and Design. Visitors are invited to step into Judith Schechter's Supernatural, an 8-foot stained glass dome where beauty, nature, and imagination converge. Learn more at sfmcd.org. VisitorsCoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and your NPR station, and from Rhodes Scholar, celebrating 50 years of transformative learning adventures for adults in over 100 countries. Learn more at rhodesscholar.org/explore.
It's Here and Now. The FBI arrested a suspect today accused of planting pipe bombs in Washington, D.C. the day before the riot at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Attorney General Pam Bondi made the announcement earlier today.
Today's arrest happened because the Trump administration has made this case a priority.
The FBI says a man named Brian Cole from Virginia planted the bombs outside the Republican and Democratic National Party headquarters just hours before large groups of people gathered on the Capitol Mall. NPR's Ryan Lucas covers the Justice Department. Ryan, what do we know about the suspect and what he's accused of?
Well, we don't know a whole lot about him at this point in time beyond what you already said. His name is Brian Cole, as you mentioned. He's 30 years old. He's from Woodbridge, Virginia, which is not far outside of Washington, D.C. Beyond that, at this point in time, authorities did not offer any new information, any information about his background, about who he is. Court papers don't make don't provide any information on that as well. As for what he's accused of, what he's charged with, the charges at this point in time are there are two counts. He's being charged for transporting an explosive device in interstate commerce, as well as the attempted malicious destruction by means of explosive materials. Those are the two charges that he's facing right now, although I will say that officials were quite clear in the press conference today that there very well may be more charges brought as this case evolves.
Did they say anything about a possible motive, political or otherwise?
You know, that is obviously one of the huge questions hanging over the case of these pipe bombs. It's something that we would love to have an answer on. Officials did not offer anything on that question today. They were asked multiple times at the press conference. They just kind of parried those questions away. It's something that we will continue to keep an eye on, of course, but no, there is nothing at this point in time about possible motive or political leanings of the suspect who is in custody.
Ryan, I'm sure you remember this was a very chaotic day, and news of the bombs, which did not explode, only added an extra layer of fear and tension over Washington. But it's been nearly 5 years with no new developments. What was the break in this case that led to the arrest?
You know, it's interesting. What FBI Director Kash Patel and Deputy Director Dan Bongino both said today was that it wasn't any new evidence, it wasn't any new tips that came in that led to this suspect. What they said they did is they brought in a new team of investigators and experts to sift through the data that they had collected over the past almost 5 years. And through that, they generated new investigative leads. And that's what ultimately brought them to the suspect, Brian Cole. Now, according to court papers, what they found that led them to Cole is they had purchase receipts that they trolled through everything that they could find. And it turns out that Cole, they say, bought multiple items that were consistent with the components that were used to make these pipe bombs, things like galvanized pipes, end caps, red and black electrical wire, a white kitchen-style timer. And then it was also cell phone tower data that put Cole's cell phone allegedly in the environs of the RNC and DNC the night that the bombs were placed, January 5th of 2021.
President Trump granted clemency to the January 6th rioters that day. It also included, well, it did include all defendants accused or convicted of offenses related to events that occurred at or near the Capitol on January 6th. Is it possible, I know some people are asking this question, that this suspect would be covered under that clemency order?
You know, it's impossible to say at this point in time. It's something that did not come up at the press conference. I will say that officials did not mention January 6th, the attack on the Capitol, at the press conference today. But certainly it's a question that people have in the back of their minds and something that we'll have to keep an eye on as this case continues to evolve.
Okay, NPR's Ryan Lucas, thanks very much.
Thank you.
A is for affordability. We are all talking about the prices of groceries, electricity, health and car insurance, all going north. Also housing. The median cost of a home sold in this country is more than $410,000, out of reach for many. So last month, the Trump administration floated the idea of a 50-year mortgage. Now, many of us have 30-year mortgages. 50 would mean lower monthly payments, but also a lot more interest over time. Let's talk about the idea with economist Alison Schrager. She's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, also a Bloomberg opinion columnist. Alison, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Is there anything you like about this idea?
Well, I mean, as long as we're in a world where there's a 30-year mortgage, I mean, why not go with a 50-year? It really, in a lot of ways, isn't that different. We do have this really big problem, which is interest rates were very low for a very long time, like historically low, and people got really cheap mortgages for a variety of reasons. And then inflation came back and interest rates went up. And now you have, like, you know, a very large share of the population with a really cheap mortgage, and it's never probably going to be that cheap again. So they're reluctant to move, and that's making the housing supply issue even worse. So I understand policymakers' motivation to lower the monthly payments of people who are taking on mortgages. And while I said I have some concerns with it, it might be better than the other alternatives that will probably come along.
You've heard the question raised of, well, 50 years. That's a whole lot of interest, right? I've had a 30-year mortgage. I think now it's a 15-year mortgage, but already I see on my statement how much interest I'm paying over so many years. With a 50-year mortgage, it's that much more, right? For, say, a $400,000 house. I mean, that's an astronomical amount of interest over a long period of time, isn't it?
It is, but it depends on how you think about it. First of all, most people don't pay off their mortgage at 30 years. Most people move, or they refinance, or they pay it off early. So most people aren't paying the interest over the 30 years, and they probably wouldn't over the 50 years either. Also, I mean, it depends. There's also an opportunity cost for your money. You do have those lower payments. You know, just because you're paying more interest isn't necessarily bad.
Okay, so let's say we're in a world where there is a 50-year mortgage. One of the big trade-offs is, for me, the home buyer, I'm not building up equity very quickly, right? Most of my payments are going to the bank instead of me gradually owning more and more and, you know, gaining more equity in the house. I mean, that's really important, isn't it?
It can be. I mean, it depends on your financial outlook. You could also argue that, you know, Americans, you know, we're a big culture of home ownership. Housing really dominates homeowners' portfolios. So you could also argue that, yeah, you're building up less equity, but you're also freeing up more money to invest in other assets and better diversifying yourself.
So if I have a lower mortgage payment, less money is going into my house, perhaps, because I have a 50-year mortgage, are you saying it would be better because I can put more of my money into other things?
So instead, if you put all your money into a down payment, you're effectively hoping that when you sell your house that its value will go up. That's not a guarantee. You're taking a bet on a single asset. So it would be better, say, if you could afford a lower down payment or a lower monthly payment and put some of that extra savings in, say, an S&P 500 index funds. And on average, it's just less risky and you'll make more money.
If to some degree this whole conversation, you know, proposed idea out there is to make homes potentially more affordable for more people, does it address the affordability issue? I can imagine if this loan product makes it easier for more people to buy a house, then you have more demand for homes and the prices actually go up, less affordable than today.
Yeah, I mean, the big sort of problem with our housing market is we do tend to do everything we can to subsidize demand, but also restrict supply. So, you know, it doesn't do a lot to sort of change zoning so you can build more housing or, say, maybe build a granny flat in your backyard or rent out a room or all these sorts of things that you have zoning restrictions on, which would all increase supply.
Let me kind of back up to a broader question here. the concept that seems to be underlying this is a way to get more people who don't own homes to own homes. Is that, as an economist, is that necessarily good?
No. You know, we're very fixated on home ownership. And I got to be honest, I never owned a home until I was more than 40. I have to admit, I actually do really love home ownership now that I'm part of it. I love feeling that connection to the space. I like the security it does give me. But as an economist, it's very hard for me to justify it. I said, first of all, it takes up an enormous part of my net worth. You know, the amount of money I had to put onto a down payment. It does mean I feel really undiversified financially. And also, as I said, because I've locked into this low mortgage rate, it feels harder for me to move. I think we are particularly overly fixated on home ownership for young people, which is when particularly when you should be mobile. And as I said, we kind of always look at home ownership as this necessarily a good financial investment. A lot of times you buy a house and you have to sell it for less than you paid for it. That also does happen. I think a lot of people don't really account for that either.
So in some cases, if a 50-year mortgage were on the table, and I imagine I'm only going to be in my condo or my house for, I don't know, 5-8 years, in some cases, is it a better idea to rent, you think?
Yeah, for sure, especially if you're only going to be there for a few years. There's also a lot of transactions costs involved with buying and selling a home.
Right.
All the fees to the broker, like if this is like 6%, you have to pay to a broker, not to mention all the closing costs. And a lot of people also don't appreciate their costs above the mortgage. There's HOA fees, there's taxes. All of these can be very substantial. If you're only going to be there for a couple of years, odds are this is not worthwhile.
We've been talking to Alison Schrager, a Bloomberg opinion columnist who writes about economics. She's also a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Alison, good to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Great. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Hear It Now.
Live from NPR News in Boston, I'm Sharon Brody. Today, the New York Times filed a lawsuit against the Pentagon. The Times accuses the Defense Department of violating the First Amendment, infringing on the constitutional rights of journalists by enforcing new restrictions on reporting. The policy requires reporters to agree to restrictions on activities, including requests for story tips and inquiries to Pentagon sources. Journalists from the Times and NPR are among dozens of journalists who refused to sign the documents and instead surrendered their Pentagon press credentials. New York Attorney General Letitia James is challenging the authority of an acting U.S. attorney in Albany who's investigating her. Her lawyers argue that John Sarcone's appointment was improper and therefore subpoenas he issued are invalid. The dispute centers on Sarcone's role in investigating regulatory lawsuits James filed against Donald Trump and the National Rifle Association. At least 4 countries have announced they are pulling out of next year's Eurovision Song Contest. This decision follows the organizers' choice to allow Israel to compete. That's despite concerns over Israel's conduct in the Gaza War. Dutch, Spanish, Irish, and Slovenian broadcasters say they plan to sit out the competition. You're listening to Here and Now.
Afternoon support for KQED comes from Gardens of Golden Gate Park. Lightscape at San Francisco Botanical Garden opens November 21st. Visitors are invited to a luminous blend of art, sound, and nature that transforms the garden after dark. Tickets at gggp.org. Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy works to create a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. Weather Service says no major changes in the forecast the next several days. A few showers over the coastal waters expected through the next few days. A slight warming trend starts tomorrow with good weather through the weekend. No rain forecast through the weekend into the start of next week so far.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority. and offering support in taking on everything life demands. With therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. And the Music Emporium, guitar sellers for more than 55 years, celebrating the enduring presence of music made on the front porch and center stage. You can learn more at themusicemporium.com.
It's here and now. New Delhi is rolling out the red carpet today for Russia's President Vladimir Putin. It is his first state visit to India since Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. NPR's Dia Hadid reports the visit is partly an exercise for both countries to signal defiance to the Trump administration.
It's not unusual for old-timers here to hum this when you ask about the relationship between India and Russia. This Bollywood classic goes, "The red hat on my head is Russian, and still my heart is Indian." India has always steered an independent foreign policy, but its relationship with Russia goes way back to when it was the Soviet Union. And that's because India's arch-rival Pakistan was an ally of the United States. And India's engagement with the US is newer. It has been friendly, noticeably in the first Trump administration, like when the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi threw a rally for Trump.
Namaste! Namaste!
But relationships soured in Trump's second term. In August, the administration slapped 25% tariffs on many exports from India and then doubled it because ever since Russia invaded Ukraine, India has been purchasing cheap Russian oil. There were public tirades, like from trade advisor Peter Navarro, who spoke to Fox News in August. He characterized India's oil purchases this way.
Well, it fuels the Russian war machine. India is nothing but a laundromat for the Kremlin.
A laundromat for the Kremlin. So Putin's visit this week comes as New Delhi finds itself entangled in a war that pits its old relationship, Russia, against its new relationship, the United States. Srinath Raghavan is a historian of India's foreign policy. He says the visit signals
India will not get browbeaten into abandoning or diluting or modulating a relationship simply at the whims of an American president.
The visit is important for practical reasons, too. India's military is kitted out with Russian armaments across its Navy, Air Force and Army.
I think a key watch point will be to see if there are any major defense deals that are reached during Putin's visit.
Chetej Bajpayee is a senior research fellow for South Asia at the London-based think tank Chatham House. He says that's important because
there have been no major defense deals concluded between both countries since the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
And he says, don't discount the India-US relationship.
There's very strong linkages and functional cooperation between India and the U.S. So despite the bad blood, India conducts more joint military exercises with the U.S. than with any other country. They've conducted 5 military exercises just this year.
And not all Indians will welcome Putin as his war against his neighbor, Ukraine, rages on. On Tuesday, families of more than 60 men gathered in the capital. They held up signs demanding Moscow return their sons, who they say were tricked into fighting for Russia. Like Surendra Dahiya. On the phone, his uncle, Sunil Chaudhary, says Dahiya paid $4,000 to a man who promised him a job as a cook in the Russian army. The last they heard of him was from September. Dahiya said he was in Ukraine on a front line near Donetsk. And just as Putin is returning to India, Chaudhry hopes his nephew, too, can return home. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Mumbai.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Prices for everything from cars to coffee are soaring, but you can count on some things getting cheaper because they have been for decades. Computers. Storing and processing information has gotten more efficient and more cost-effective over time.
The number of transistors incorporated in a chip will approximately double every 24 months.
But will that last? On the next morning edition from NPR News.
More tomorrow morning, KQED News and the California Report on Friday. Coming up this Sunday.
Hey, I'm Sam Sanders, and I'm happy to say that I am back in the Bay. The Sam Sanders Show is coming to KQED on Sunday afternoons. I'll keep you up to date on culture, talk with the people shaping today, and bring a little bit of joy to start your week. From big ideas to good laughs, The Sam Sanders Show is just the conversation you need to wrap your weekend. Join me starting December 7th here on 88.5.
This Sunday, 3 o'clock. Support for KQED comes from the Oakland Interfaith Gospel Choir presenting their 40th annual holiday concert, a joyous celebration of music and community, December 6th, Paramount Theater in Oakland. More at oigc.org/holiday. And BART, helping writers discover festive finds and gift ideas on BARTable, spotlighting places to shop and explore by taking BART. More information on holiday shopping near BART at bart.gov/BARTable.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and your NPR station, and from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at viking.com. And Americans United for Separation of Church and State, defending church-state separation and the First Amendment, including freedom of the press, for nearly 80 years. Learn more at au.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. It's Here and Now. All right, if you grew up gaming and a grown-up told you to put the console down and go outside and play, raise your hand. Well, game developers are now harnessing powerful computers to reproduce the experience of nature inside games. 99% Invisible and the WBUR podcast Endless Thread have been exploring these advancements. And reporter Dean Russell tells us that when developers try to simulate reality, it has positive and negative effects on the real world.
Since the start of gaming history, virtual nature has played many roles and been represented in many ways. Space War, a 1962 game on a circular screen computer, was maybe the first with quote-unquote nature. Space, aka white dots on a black backdrop. When games advanced, virtual nature also evolved.
As always with the industry, it's usually a push toward more verisimilitude and toward more accuracy.
Alenda Chang is a professor at UC Santa Barbara and a gamer. Alenda studies video game ecology, wrote a book on it. Why would an academic study ecology in games?
For a lot of people, that is their weekly dosage of encounter with the natural environment.
Yeah, I haven't been hiking this week, but I have been to the mountains of Hyrule.
Oh, excellent.
Hyrule Kingdom, Zelda, she gets it.
Alenda says nature has evolved in gaming. From the early days of 8-bit graphics where nature served as pixelated backgrounds, to today, where players interact with their natural settings in diverse and semi-realistic ways. Think Minecraft. Minecraft is, by the numbers, the most popular video game in the world. Over 350 million copies have been sold since it launched in 2009. The game is a Lego-like world of 16 pixel by 16 pixel by 16 pixel blocks. Minecraft has no points, no prescribed goal, really. You mine with pickaxes and punch trees for lumber. Yeah, punch trees. And build. Or explore. Part of the draw of Minecraft is its vastness and biodiversity. A single Minecraft setting has 9,000 times the surface area of the Earth. The game has over 60 different environments, or biomes, each with their own plants, animals, and landscapes. The word for this in gaming is open world.
Open world is this moniker that gets attached to games, meaning you as a player can traverse these virtual spaces without the impression of having limits.
In open world games, nature is neither just a place setting nor a means to an end. They are immersive with seemingly boundless landscapes where experiencing nature can be a goal in its own right.
Thinking about ecology in games, I think it's a huge development because you can now tell stories where you can, by all appearances, wander around a fully realized immersive game environment.
These features of open worlds, their diversity and scale, the way you can walk forever and never see the same scene twice, that experience is possible because of something called procedural generation. Procedural generation is a technique that creates nature algorithmically, not manually. You don't place every tree in the game. You give the computer rules, and the computer populates the scene for you. This is something Agnes Larson told me. She's game director at Mojang, maker of Minecraft.
It's not possible to design each part of an endless world by hand. Procedural generation is the reason to why we can create this world with different biomes, different kind of building blocks. There are oceans, we create continents.
Procedural generation came out of the late 70s as a way of creating rudimentary but semi-randomized grid-like environments. Nowadays, Minecraft developers tell the game's software the rules of the world, like where mangrove trees grow or which creatures live in which climates, and the software executes.
Each thing is simple by design, and that means that it can kind of be combined in an endless amount of complex ways.
In a lot of ways, it makes sense that nature has inspired the games industry. But what's maybe less expected is the way the gaming industry has, on a real, tangible level, shaped the living world. How much have video games influenced nature?
In my field of work, heavily.
Taisha Fabritius works in Zurich for a company called Esri. Esri uses video game technologies like procedural generation and game engines to map the real world, or even recreate it. Digital twins are used primarily in city planning. They're not exact replicas, but living models of a place. And the reason they are possible is because of technologies pioneered by the games industry. Procedural generation can invent a place, like in Minecraft. It can also use rules in real-world data to digitally approximate a place that already exists, easily. So instead of some person painstakingly sculpting each building and tree, you can give the computer a map and information about the landscape. How many stories each building is, or how many trees on each block. And the program uses procedural generation to invent the rest, or fill in the blanks.
When you bring in real data into game engines, and you can create these believable, very visual, very immersive experiences, that obviously, quote-unquote, changes the game when it comes to actually making real decisions in the real world.
What Esri does with game engines has been particularly helpful in the age of climate change. As nature itself changes, we need to imagine what will come and how to prepare for the worst. LA used Esri for response and recovery efforts during the wildfires earlier this year. Taisha says Esri can recreate those fires, allow you to revisit them again and again to understand what went wrong and how to plan for next time.
You can be there and see it. And so you can see it and you're fully immersed in it, and it helps you to plan for ways that you can mitigate this then.
While this pursuit of a truer virtual nature has made its way into tools for predicting sea level rise and preparing for wildfires, it also comes at a big cost. The Sustainable Games Alliance says the industry accounts for 50 million tons of CO2 a year, more than Hollywood. So in terms of the environment, Professor Alenda Chang says gaming is a mixed bag.
I have to acknowledge the sort of environmental impact of the powerful computers and graphical processing units on the world, right? But I think also games do have a really profound influence on people's understandings or perceptions or attitudes toward the natural world, or at least they can.
Take Minecraft. Punch down all the trees and you're out. Resources are finite, just like in nature. Maybe that sounds small, but again, Minecraft is the most popular game in the world. 20% of its players are kids. One small study found kids who played Minecraft learned more about sustainability than kids who didn't.
Games are, you know, these really incredible storytelling machines, and they can just leave us with a feeling, or they can leave us with a sensation. And that might be enough to propel somebody to think differently or to care about something that isn't just them.
That's reporter Dean Russell. He works for Endless Thread, which is partnering with 99% Invisible to cover the impact of gaming on the real world. We have more of these stories at hereandnow.org.
Support for Endless Thread content in Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creator of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Pete has been hiding out in Adelaide for a year, suspended, isolated, and off the radar. But in the episode Sieve and Sort, a sudden emergency pulls him back into the action, throwing him into high-stakes decisions and old tensions with the RFDS team. Don't miss the new season of RFDS, Royal Flying Doctor Service, tonight at 8 p.m. on KQED+. Support for KQED comes from Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. More at Xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that. KQED's newsletter, One Good Thing, helps you rediscover the Bay Area you call home with local recs and uplifting reflections about art, culture, and nature. Brought to you every week by Alexis Madrigal. Sign up. It's free. KQED.org/onegoodthing.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, StoryWorth will publish their stories and color photos into a book to keep for generations. Learn more at StoryWorth.com. And City Space Productions, WBUR's creative studio for custom podcasts that tell a brand story to ignite engagement, reach new audiences, or establish thought leadership. WBUR.org/creative studio.
It's Here and Now. I don't know about you, Peter, but my cooking repertoire, such that it is, needs a bit of a refresh. You?
Well, yeah, considering I haven't gotten around to making dinner all week, so I'd say. So, yes, for sure.
Confessional. Well, the good news for you and for me is our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, has been pouring over, not coffee, but cookbooks, and has a list of her favorites from 2025. Hi, Kathy.
Hello, Scott. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Kathy. So it looks like you've got a different approach this year to making your list of favorites. How's that?
Well, I went through huge piles of cookbooks there in every room, and I decided this year that I would focus on three books by authors whose names might not be well known. Even though a lot of famous authors this year published books, I decided to take a look for something different, and I wound up with three books written by women. One is a Ukrainian writer, cook, who lives in Rhode Island. Another is a Malaysian chef who also happens to be a trained psychologist who grew up in Australia and now lives in London. And then a Lebanese American from Michigan.
All right, let's go. Let's talk first about Baking and the Meaning of Life by Helen Goh. Wow, Meaning of Life. How so?
I know. Well, she's the psychologist, if you hadn't guessed.
Yeah.
You may be familiar with her name from the Ottolenghi cookbook. She was a co-author of Yotam Ottolenghi's Sweet and also Comfort. This is her first solo book, and I found the title compelling and a little bit annoying because could I really find the meaning of life? So I started cooking, and the first thing I made, I hope I say these correctly, are Lao Gan Ma cheese crackers. So a cheese cracker is somewhat familiar, the idea of a cracker that's got a real pow of cheese. But this had Parmesan cheese in it and a little lemon juice, but it also has chili crisp, really spicy chili oil with crispy bits of chili.
Oh, I know this. And you got it right. Lauganma,
Oh, good. Thank you. And finally, chopped scallions. And these crackers wowed me in such a big way. They would be incredible with holiday drinks, champagne, or a cheese platter, or even hot tea. Just absolutely fabulous. And then I tried her broccoli leek and ricotta pie and really got over my fear of working with phyllo dough. She's a very smart writer. And did I find the meaning of life? Well, you know, I'll tell you, I did get reminded once again of the joy of baking and giving baked gifts to people. And, you know, that's a big part of the meaning of life. So, I say yes.
Kathy, I know we got to move on, but did you say you were afraid of something in the kitchen?
Even me.
You heard it here.
Even me. Okay.
<All right>. breaking news. All right, let's get to the next one.
I
know, right. It's top of the segment. All right. So, I hear you're also a fan. I'm not sure if I'm saying this right. Chesnok, is that right? It features food from the Caucasus. Yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
And this is the mountainous region around the Black Sea.
Yeah, this is called Chesnok, and it's Chesnok, sorry, cooking from my corner of the diaspora, recipes from Eastern Europe, the Caucasus, and Central Asia by Polina Chesnokova. She was born in the Ukraine, raised in the U.S. by a Russian mother and an Armenian father, and her new book, Chesnok Meat, had translate to Head of Garlic. This is a book filled with beautiful essays and time-tested family recipes. And in full transparency, Polina is a friend and a former student from one of my food and memoir writing classes. And I am just so proud of her. This is just a beautiful book. And I made two recipes, one in particular. Let's see if I can say this right. Penovani Kachapuri. And this is a Georgian flaky cheese bread. It was like the most insanely good cheese tart or grilled cheese. You use pre-bought puff pastry, feta cheese, mozzarella, and ricotta. It bakes up into this golden brown puff. Absolutely fabulous. And then I also made her borscht, which is that famous beet and cabbage and carrot and beef stew. And it was so comforting and warming, and we ate it for days happily.
Wow. Kathy, we got a quick minute here to talk about Lebanese baking. Go.
Yes, this is by Maureen Aboud. This is a wonderful book. I made her honey buns, but also I made her white chocolate pistachio cookies, which are so simple and will be ideal for the holidays. Ground pistachios are in the dough, sprinkled on top, and they're dipped into melted white chocolate. This is just a book filled with interesting and also unusual flavors, and I found her writing very clear, and it really spoke to me and got me through some complex recipes very easily.
Wow. We've been talking about cookbooks and pronunciation, the meaning of life, with Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst. Her list will be at our website, hereandnow.org. Kathy, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. And Scott, I haven't eaten lunch today, so I'm kind of... That was the segment for me, I have to say. You're listening.
Go get Chesnok. There you go.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and the Music Emporium. Guitar sellers for more than 55 years, celebrating the enduring presence of music made on the front porch and center stage. You can learn more at themusicemporium.com.
Raw marinated crab slathered in blood red spicy sweet sauce. Peking duck with the crackliest golden bronze skin you can imagine. And Laotian fermented pork sausages and jiaosam served inside an East Bay bowling alley. I'm Luke Tsai, food editor for KQED, and these are just a few of the best dishes I ate in 2025. Read the rest at kqed.org/arts, where KQED's Arts and Culture Desk also looks at the year's best in music, fashion, visual art, and more.
All things considered, ahead in just a minute. Julie Depish now with afternoon traffic over in Oakland first.
There was a pickup truck that caught on fire in westbound 580 Golf Links Road that was in the two right lanes for a while. Just cleared that. Traffic is completely recovered now. Some road work will slow you down in San Jose if you're on the Guadalupe Parkway northbound from Alma Avenue up to 280. That right lane taken away. Slow from Alvagin Expressway. And more construction work, Martinez Highway 4 westbound at Center Avenue. Going on until later tonight. Right now, back up to Morello. Julie Depish for KQED.
Traffic support from Shen Yun Performing Arts. Support for KQED comes from Rising Team, creator of Super Manager AI, giving leaders at all levels a leadership personal trainer and coaching partner to help build essential skills.